Okay, thanks. So Sandy Feder a few weeks ago asked me to give this informal talk. And he specifically told me that I cannot talk about the stuff I talked about during the conference a few weeks ago. So that's the reason I choose to talk about the subject of beam splitting of either atoms or electrons in non-uniform magnetic field because of topological reason. But since Sandy has returned to Stanford, I will take the liberty of his absence, still talk a little bit about very recent work we have done with
so
my.
What would be the topic of today?
Today I will still talk about beam splitting, but I will spend 5 minutes briefly mention this the result of very recent work. My students Snow Kwima and also Yafek involved in this work. So basically, what we recently did is to look at the spin singulate mod states of spin one bosons, okay, and to look at the what happened if one applies the magnetic field, whether there will be induced nematic order in the system. Okay, so basically, the issue is we start with a spin singulate mod state, apply z direction magnetic field, and to see spontaneous symmetry breaking in the x y plane. Okay.
What's the dimensionality?
This is a high dimension. So the main result is if we just take into account the linear Z-Mann splitting, then there will be a lower critical field and upper critical field, between which there will be a nematic order present. Okay, so the nematic order develops in this regime, and the physics close to critical points can be mapped into a ferromagnetic XXZ model, which can be handled with great confidence and accuracy. Okay, so and particularly, so if you look at the XXZ model, which is the phase diagram, which is defining the beta and the HZ plane.
Is it in order in 3 dimensions or is it in 2 dimensions?
So this is a 3 dimension, for instance. We take a 3 dimension case, and the beta is determined by the intrinsic scattering, etc.
What's the original model without magnetic field?
So spin one bosons with anti-ferromagnetic interactions.
Yeah, you write down a model, maybe not everyone.
And the unit filling?
This is n equal to 2 filling. So the model, the microscopic model would be so these are the lattice size, okay, and K. Let me finish this one. So the charge degree of freedom in the Mach limit when the hopping is smaller than the charging energy, then charge is fixed. So you're basically left with spin degree of freedom and the hopping.
You can just immediately rewrite everything in terms of spin lengths.
Yes. Not necessarily. No. That's not true. The difference between this problem and spin lattice is, in this case, the on-site Hilbert space has different spins. Okay, that's the difference.
On-site?
Yeah. For each individual site, if you have two particles, the Hilbert space at the one given site, you will have s equal to 0, s equal to 2, and you will have s equal to 4 if you have n even number of particles. Okay.
Oh, you mean that it's not one particle per set?
No. This is 2, right? Uh-huh. I mean n equal to 2. This is for n equal to 2 and higher, okay? Even. So it's not a spin model, but it's related. You can map into the quantum rotor model. You know, some spin model, you can also do that. But the physics and the Hilbert space structure is different. And this is what we found when you apply magnetic field, start with spin singulate state, apply magnetic field, then the nematic order can develop between the lower critical point and the upper critical point. And furthermore, the magnetization increase linearly, OK? So this linear law here and here, the solution are exact, because this problem around the critical point can be mapped to Dirac boson problem, which can be handled systematically.
Sorry, where did I didn't catch where the XXC model came in? It was around?
Around the critical point. Yeah, you map the problem into the XXC model.
And what's the connection between that? Can you make a physical connection in that mapping and the Fermi, attractive Fermi-Hilbert model, where you get this mapping for strong interactions into XXC?
I haven't thought about attractive Fermi, but we can talk about that later. Okay. So this is a recent thing we just finished. Okay. But Sandy didn't want me to talk about it. I briefly mentioned the result. So that's all I wanted to say about this part, which fits well into the quantum gas program.
but let's see, just pause a bit. So what's the problem? So what's the main thing you want to tell people? What particular part do you find particularly interesting?
Particularly interesting is that you can use external magnetic field. You can apply external magnetic field on Z direction, and then induce the magnetic order, which shouldn't be there at a zero field. Okay?
And
these are the states. You start with singular states.
This would be without the quadratic Zeeman.
This is without quadratic Zeeman. So if you have quadratic Zeeman,
so
what we look at is actually the spin singular state is unstable with respect to quadratic Zeeman, and then you get a linear magnetic order. Okay, so this is the phase diagram for zero quadratic Zeeman effect. And if you don't have Zeeman field, just have quadratic Zeeman, you get a linear.
For the purpose of getting the magnetic order, wouldn't it be even better with the
Zeeman? That's correct. If you apply quadratic Zeeman, you stabilize the hidden, I call the hidden fluctuating order right away. And you get a linear.
In some ways, trivially force everything to zero.
Yes. Yes. But this is less trivial because there's a critical point. Okay. But so, and furthermore, there's a difference. This is XY type of pneumatic induced, because the spontaneous symmetry breaking is the XY plane, which is observed. The rotation invariance is observed by the Hamiltonian itself. This one actually is icing type of pneumatic. The up-down pneumatic, right? It's pinned around the Z direction. Yes?
There was a question. Yeah. So I just want to be really clear on the experimental situation. So there's a lattice in all three directions.
Yeah.
And then you apply a magnetic field along Z, and you should see a different order, right? And what's so? And there are experiments already on lattices with bosons and mixing spin states is not so hard. So
those experiments are basically. I mean, most of experiments, the spins are completely polarized. So, you need to start with, for instance, zero magnetic field, okay? And then you first have to study the zero field phases. And the claim is, in the zero field at a small Hopping, you will have a spin singular state. That was not studied. Okay.
He hasn't finished asking his question.
Yeah. So my question was. So if experimentalists now turn on the magnetic field, in the right circumstance that you describe, how would they observe this pneumatic wood? What do they see? How do they do in the experiment?
Okay, so that's a slightly different issue. I mean, we don't have expertise to study this subject in principle, but I can tell you what I can foresee. You can use the light scattering, for instance. Okay, use the small angle light scattering experiment. So the spin singular mass day. Will have very weak forward scattering. If you look at the elastic scattering of light from the many body state, if you start with a spin singular state, then the forward scattering is very weak. But if you have pneumatic ordered state, then the forward scattering will be enhanced. Okay. So in principle, you can look at the forward scattering. That's a simple example, but there are more sophisticated proposals about how to map out the spin correlations using optical method.
You were saying that ultimately you map everything onto the XXZ model.
Close to critical point.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. I'm just about the criticality.
Right.
So in terms of And XXZ model is basically a model of single component bosons. Am I right?
Yes, you can think
it's
that
the
way.
Same universe.
You can think that way.
I'm just trying to understand in terms of this single component bosons.
Mm-hmm.
Your nematic order corresponds to what?
Condensed phase.
Condensed in which sense?
The single boson.
Jacobi board, Mott insulator. What's
no,
the
no, no. All these states do not break the translation symmetry.
I see.
These are all the.
Am I right? It's basically as if I raise chemical potential above the gap in the Mott insulator.
Yeah.
So on the left side, I have Mott insulator, and then I have chemical potential, which is an analog of magnetic field, and I just raise it. So I'm trying to understand.
So if you take if you look at the problem from the boson point of view, look at the one single branch of boson, which is S equal to two branch. Okay, this is the magnon. This is the magnon excitation. When you put the magnetic field in, this is the lowest lying magnon excitation.
Uh-huh.
And then what you do is you basically increase the magnetic field.
I see.
This comes
down. To the right of your critical point, you have a dilute gas of this.
In the right, in terms of magnon, these are fully gapped here and here. The magnon spectrum becomes gapless here. Afterwards, they condense.
I see. Yeah. There is a dilute gas,
So very good question. So the breaking of the U1 symmetry of dilute bosons is directly connected with breaking of the pneumatic XY symmetry. That's correct statement. Okay.
Okay,
so I will start to talk about this idea of beam splitting. So let me give a short introduction about very well-known physics, Barrett's phase. And I talk about Barrett's phase using this language of coverage, because I find it's very convenient. So the statement basically is if we have... okay, thanks. Yeah. So if we have Hamiltonian, for instance, which depending on... two parameters, and these two parameters actually is periodic. Okay, and send the t goes to infinite, very very slowly, varying potential of some parameter in the problem. Then the evolution of the wave function can be easily expressed in terms of these are the so-called instantaneous eigenstates. Okay, at each point it satisfies this condition. Then this the evolution of real quantum state will be simply this one times t plus t will be Barrett's phase times this one times a dynamical phase. So this is what happened to these eigenstates in the very slowly varying potential. So if you look at the instantaneous eigenstates, in addition to the dynamical phase, there will be a geometrical phase pick up during the evolution, and the form of this phase can be easily written in a form which is, let me put it this way. This is skew symmetric, which means when you interchange these two, you get anti-symmetric property. And this is the coverage defined for alpha beta. Okay. You can generalize for many time-dependent potentials. this is the integration is over the area. So in the case we have two parameters, we have G1, G2, G1, and when time evolves, the G2, G1 will enclose a finite area in the parameter space. So this integration, this is the quantity only dependent on G alpha, G beta, right? So everything after taking this expectation value, the only dependence you have is the dependence on G1 and G2. So this integration can be carried over in the parameter space. Okay. So this is the general structure of Berry's phase. The most well-known example, for instance, is the spin a half. And for the spin a half case, let's introduce a magnetic field, which have this form, which means that I fix the z direction amplitude and then have periodical modulation in the xy component, which corresponds to a rotating field, okay, rotating around z axis. And so, for instance, we can choose this one as cosine omega t. This is sine omega t. And in this particular case, then we can show that the Berry's curvature, and maybe let me introduce gamma alpha beta. So I introduce a field which, and this field is basically one half of B, BQ. This is the monopole field seated in the B space, in the parameter space, right? And this is very well known result. If you calculate the Berry's phase due to this curvature, or due to this T field, then what you will get is simply, say, 2 pi 1 over cos theta times S. S is 1 half in this case. So this is the famous result of Berry in his original paper. So this basically is a solid angle which you count the flux of this monopole field. When you notate the magnetic field, then given the theta angle, then you know what's the solid angle. And so the phase acquired by say spin up stay pointing around this direction is precisely this one. Okay. So, and what is also true is following this formula, if you look at the energy splitting of spin up and spin down states in the rotating frame, then you will have splitting from the dynamical Zeeman effect plus 2 times gamma times frequency, which I use. So actually, the splitting of two levels. If this is the case when we have, say, B equal to static field, non-rotating field, if we have this splitting, then when we rotate the magnetic field, these two levels actually have further splitting, and this shift in the splitting is basically proportional to Berry's phase and then the frequency. So these are the well-known results and actually being observed, this kind of shift in the resonance experiment. It's a resonance, nuclear magnetic resonance. I think it's a quadrupole experiment. Yeah.
It's just a usual NMR cast in different language. It's exactly the usual NMR treatment, but it's a equivalent. So.
Yeah. So I think in the experiment they look at the resonance frequency as a function of rotating frequency, and they see the linear difference.
What's the condition of applicability of Mary's theorem to this experiment. Basically, that the most right jump should be much smaller than the energy split.
That's correct. Omega has to be small compared with the Z man.
This would be enough to discuss.
Yeah. You enforce the adiabaticity. Yeah, that has to be observed. Otherwise, there will be a transition up and down transitions. Okay. So, for many condensed matter systems, one is perhaps more interested in what happened to the transport, right? When you apply periodical potentials, for instance. And that subject was actually studied almost simultaneously by Fallos. I think it's in 1982 or 83. So there's another curvature when you have external field. I think in the literature people call it adiabatic curvature. So this is connected with the pumping. So I'm basically now giving a sort of more proper description about what do I mean by pumping. So again, we consider Hamiltonian, which depending on a few periodical potentials. So I have a few periodical potentials, and I have time-dependent Hamiltonian, and all the time dependence is very slow, okay? And then, and they derive a very compact form for the charge transport. So if you have periodical potentials, and then if you look at the DC transport in closed geometry, say, if we are interested in what happened of a ring, okay? In the ring, we have fermions living in the ring, and then we apply external periodical potentials acting on this ring. And we are interested in the mass or charge transport across one given cross-section every period, per period. So we talk about the DC transport induced by periodical modulation of the system, right? And this charge or mass transport per period, right? This quantity can be expressed in terms of this form. And so let me define this phi. Phi, the meaning of phi is that we choose a wave function, say one particle wave function, okay? And then we have boundary condition fixed in this way. Okay. And phi can, in principle, a variable between 0 to 2 pi. So you get arbitrary boundary conditions in this way. So the charge transport in the presence of external magnetic field is basically determined by the sensitivity of wave functions with respect to the change of boundary condition. And this has to be evaluated at phi equal to 0. Okay? You take the derivative of the phi equal to 0 to see how wave function responds to the change of boundary condition, or wave function responds to basically a flux, right? Trapped inside in the center, for instance. And this sensitivity will determine the charge transfer, how easy, how difficult it is to transfer a certain mass around the system. Okay?
I think the condensed matter audience may be familiar with this, but maybe you should say a few words just for this diverse audience that why by changing this theoretically there would be DC currents in certain directions.
Well, I mean, physically it's we can imagine an easy situation like a G1, G2, two gate voltage applying on top of the system. And this gate voltage will basically perturb the system periodically, for instance, right?
Well, but we know what the mechanism is. What is the physics that drives the charge going around in certain directions?
It's because if you look at this parameter space, okay, So you have two possibilities. One is you apply these two gates in phase back and down. And then the trajectory will repeat itself. Then there will be no charge transport. Okay? However, you can apply the out of phase. That's easy to imagine. Then this formula basically tells you you will have a charge transport across
so
the system.
So what determines goes one direction and the other direction?
It depend on the phase shift between these two gates. So let me write down explicitly, for instance, this can be sine omega t, right? And the other one can be... Yeah. So the phase difference between these two gates, you know, basically determine which direction you will push this mass along. So for instance, in this case, if you push this first to do this second, you will move along this way. You reverse, you make a phi is negative, then you reverse the turn. And also in the linear response, you actually can find out the Q is basically proportional to sine of phi. And in a weak coupling, weak pumping limit. And this was established.
Maybe I'm saying something better now that you said you're saying a periodic potential area, but the periodic potential is in time. There's no spatial periodic potential you're applying to this ring or anything.
No. Yeah, it's in time, yeah. This is T is, yeah.
And it has to be fermions?
It's a time dependent. Pardon? It doesn't matter. This is very general.
So you said fermions at the
beginning. Yeah, if you have fermion, you will do it. If you have bosons, you will also do it. Yeah. And and let me make one more comment as a final remark in this introduction. Okay, so this quantity actually written in this way is not quantized; it can be any value. But Fallows and New actually established the condition under which charge pumping, charge transport can be quantized. So what they establish is if the system is fully gapped. The ground state is fully gapped from the excited state. And if during the perturbation, the gap never closed. Okay. And then in that case, the Q actually is equal to up to some boundary effect, which is small if you do it with a very large system. This one can be expressed in terms of this quantity, which is called a Chern number. So let me call it this one. And this quantity actually is quantized, defined. So basically what it means is that if the charge transport at a given boundary condition phi, and if you integrate over the charge transport at different boundary conditions, that number is quantized. Okay? And if the system is incompressible, which means fully gapped, then we know that the physics of the system cannot depend on change of the boundary condition. So the charge of transport at the phi equal to zero actually has to be equal to the Q averaged over all boundary condition, which is basically given by this formula. And this quantity actually is known to be a quantized number. So in that limit, one can talk about quantized charge transport. There are a few examples where this quantized transport can be realized. One is quantum Hall systems, and actually this kind of formula being applied very extensively to the study of quantum Hall conductance. And in nanoelectronics, in macroscopic physics, the quantized charge transport can be achieved in Coulomb-Brocade limit. Okay. So Coulomb-Brocade limit is a limit where basically no more particles is approximately quantized because of repulsive interaction between electrons. Very similar to the Mott state physics.
Context of what you're saying. So you start out with the ring, and now you're talking about quantum Hall, which is a 2D effect. So.
Yeah, so to go from here to the 2D effect, you have to modify this. You have to introduce two boundary conditions on x direction and y direction. You basically make a torus, if you like, and then study the And then you can show that the core conductance in the 2D case can be related to the similar formula, but they apply to the two boundary conditions. One is along the x direction, and one is along the y direction.
But in the experiments on quantum Hall, I don't think they're made on torsions, right? I mean, it's kind of a theory.
No. Then, so this is why this argument is very useful. This is just a device to show the number can be quantized. In reality, this charge, the Hall conductance will be always differ by the exact quantum number. But the difference is exponentially small because system is gapped. And it's not sensitive to what kind of boundary condition you choose anyway. That's the argument. Okay. So in that case, the mathematical invariant becomes relevant in reality.
And then this phi 0 actually is a single particle wave function?
This can be single particle wave function. If you have many particles, you can see this one as the ground state of many particles.
The minimum wave ground state. So this also works for bosons?
In principle, yes.
In that sense, if I want to think in terms of bosons, can I think of this as bosons on a torus like this, and then you, by means of phase imprinting, you generate a king solid one which travels around the ring, and kind of, if I imprint phase specific,
I don't know how to connect it with phase printing, but the one problem with
but
usual
would have this property of discontinuity.
What's this system? Where are you going to have king solid, like a superfluid on the ring? Because in a superfluid, the number of particles is a relevant quantity. So, and here we are discussing quantization charge. I think it's a different.
Let me comment on this one. If you do it for superfluid, you will get the finite mass transport, but it will never be quantized because superfluid you have a lot of low light excitations. So you will just get the usual transport for a compressible liquid, which is not quantized to that number, can fluctuate.
So it's true for fermions and bosons.
Yeah. So this is the Okay. Go ahead.
So is there also you talked originally about fermions and quantum Hall and all that.
Nothing to do with fermions or bosons.
Nothing to do with right. Right, but the point is that you said that it's invalidated in the case of having a boson
superfluid. No, the issue is
quantization.
You have an irrepressible state where you in principle couldn't add a new charge, like a quantum Hall state, and then you can't add charge.
The quantization occurs when, when the system is incompressible.
So what are you trying to do?
So this is an introduction, right? Now this part, it's so the adiabatic transport, now we all call it as quantum pumping. Okay, this is the definition of pumping. So the basic idea is we use time-dependent periodical potentials. Okay, and usually you need at least two, okay, for geometric reason. And then you can move the system, move the certain amount of mass or charge around the system. The advantage of this kind of transport compared with usual DC transport in electronic systems, so you apply electrical field to generate current. The advantage is in this case, since we are in the adiabatic limit, if the system is really closed and fully gapped, then this process is entropy conserved process. And there's no dissipation, etc. Okay.
Yeah, but we do this in atomic systems, you know. And neutral particles in optical lattice can be pumped, as you said, using conveyor belt. Yes.
Yeah, Yeah.
All you want is have this analysis running then.
Yeah, it's very general.
And then now they could also use the relays of magnetic traps, which you know you turn on each one of successive ones, and the new magnets gets pumped.
That's basically a very good example.
You are saying if there's a gap, this is very stable. So that means you pump.
Yeah. So if that's a gap, then
if you can't tunnel through the conveyor belt barriers, then you've got the incompressible.
Without using there is the gap and there is a geometricity.
They are connected.
Yes,
right.
Or if there's a gap, then it's very easy
to... Well, if there's a gap, that's the end of it. If you have a gap, so as long as you're doing a flow that H1 is much smaller than the gap, you're
ready.
That's the condition.
Yeah, it's easy to preserve adiabaticity if you have a gap.
Right.
But actually, what turns out, this is what I'm going to talk about. Actually, there's another kind of adiabaticity, which is not completely related to the level space in the quantum system, but actually it's related with, you know, how fast the system can be relaxed. But it's just, I think it's a simple generalization of this one, so I will talk about that part a little bit. The issue here is that this is very simplified situation. In many electronic systems, at the end you have to connect your system with leads where there are a lot of relaxation and defacing stuff going on. So, you know, this kind of thing, you know, how to apply this general idea to those systems, that's the issue. The second of all, if you have those open systems, so-called open system, connect with leads or connect with reservoirs, then how to define the adiabaticity? That's another issue. So actually, we sort of did some work in that context to generalize this idea to more general situation, not purely quantum mechanical, but there's a certain coherence in the system. And it turns out it's possible to generalize it. And the idea is very simple. Instead of dealing with wave functions, we deal with density matrix. And then in the density matrix, we instead of talking about level spacing, we talk about how fast the density matrix can relax to its equilibrium value at a given time t. Then you define the charge transport in that way. So let me mention briefly about that part, and I will spend only 5 minutes to talk about this topological spin splitting mechanism, which basically involves the Baryer space concept. That's why I give this introduction about Baryer space. Pardon? No. For the not for the system with open leads, right?
Let him proceed
to
see what he
defined. Yeah. So there are two things, right? So what I'm going to do next is that open systems. Very short. And then, second, it's got a topological splitting. Okay. Using spin rotation to split beams. Okay, so this is topological. By contrast to the usual Zeeman field gradient driven Sten-Gerlach splitting. So I would define this one more carefully in a few minutes. So to the open system, one can still talk about the mass or charge transport in various systems. And the key idea there is that we don't have well-defined wave functions, but however, if we look at the one particle density matrix, which will tell us what kind of current flow in the system. in principle, the one particle density matrix at a given time t will depend on the history. Okay, so there's a unitary evolution operator which define what's the density operator at the t, at the time t given the initial condition. But in the adiabatic approximation, you can show that the time dependence actually is completely coming from the applied field and the gradient of the applied field. It's a simple statement of adiabatic perturbation in the context of density matrix. So you're only depending on the form of the Hamiltonian at that point and the velocity, if you like, okay, how fast it changes at that local point. And this is a great simplification.
This is a Markovian.
Pardon?
This requires the dynamics to be Markovian.
Yeah. So this requires certain relaxation so that the system can be locally well defined. All right. So the in this case, the adiabaticity actually is defined as the limit when, since we don't have well-defined levels, level connected with leads, and they all smell out. So in this case, the adiabaticity can be preserved in the limit when omega, the frequency of external perturbation, is less than the relaxation time which entered the kinetic equation for one particle density matrix. And if the system is well-defined except coupled with leads, then this is the time scale involved for a particle to escape into leads. Once
it's system well-defined, the system has a local equilibrium, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, some, so this, what's the relaxation time, it all depends on details.
Is it sufficient?
Pardon?
This condition is sufficient for adiabaticity?
No, this is not.
This is, I mean, in principle, it should be smaller than all possible relaxation, right? Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But I mean, adiabaticity for a pure state, that means a closed system, adiabaticity applies for all other states of the system.
That's what we discussed before, yeah.
But for open state, it cannot apply to all possible pseudo-Argand state because these different Argand states have different decay rates.
Good.
And in the laser cooling business, I remember what we know is that it only applies to the states with the largest imaginary pulse, because that's the state you are most frequently observing, most strongly observing.
Okay, so I mean, the point here is this: if the density matrix is deviated from local equilibrium, if it takes finite time for it to relax, and this frequency is smaller than that time scale, the adiabaticity is almost a definition, as you pointed out. Now, laser cooling, I don't know. It may be involved, the laser itself is not in equilibrium, so I don't know how to talk about it. So this is a very basic definition, almost. It has to be, in principle, it has to be slower than all the possible relaxation process. Then you have local dependence. The point is, then you will have...
For the range of state that you're interested in, it contributes substantially, then it's slower than...
Yeah, but I think this is true if you're talking about adiabaticity with respect to the state with the fastest relaxation rate. Because if you are moving slower than that, you see your density matrix can be decomposed into this sort of pure state. And by the time you move across, the only one state is left because all these other states. It's like imaginary
volume. Here, this density, it's just that this tau is the shortest time.
Yeah, it's the shortest time of all your relaxation. I mean, you have many, many different relaxation processes, right, which control the different relaxation momentum, energy, etc. So I'm saying if the period is longer than all the relaxation time, that's the adiabatic limit. It's almost definition, I mean. What else you have?
Yeah, what I'm worried about is your density matrix then completely changes. It's like you have a Hamiltonian system, you are propagating imaginary time, yes?
No. This
your high excited states by the time
this
you
is not. This is not a pure Hamiltonian system. The reason why we introduced this one is to include certain statistical process, you know, which is not completely
in the...
Yeah, exactly.
The relaxation is towards the equilibrium state.
Yeah. So, relaxation to the local equilibrium, right? You have at any...
Distribution.
Time.
So it's almost in distribution. Well, some extra due to this.
That's correction. Yeah, that's the correction necessary in order to induce
current. I suggest that we move on a little bit. If it's still so murky, then you can come back on this point.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh,
well. So I think it.
Fine, continue.
It's probably clear to most of you, but I don't think that's ambiguity in this way of definition. It just has to be slow enough, and physically you are in that limit. Yeah. Okay, so let me talk about the last one I really want to talk about. So these are the introduction necessary for this one. Okay, so in the usual Z-man splitting, we split beam by applying a magnetic field around Z direction, but it's non-uniform in magnitude around another direction. Then we say that we have Z-man, which is G mu B, which is pointing in Z direction, but mainly depend on X, and sigma Z. Okay. And then because of the gradient in the X direction, then this coupling between particles and the external field basically will split, spin up and spin down particles. In this case, we know that the sigma Z is a good quantum number.
What problem are you addressing now?
I'm addressing beam splitting due to change of orientation of magnetic field in space. But the magnitude of the magnetic field is fixed. So this is
spin half atom.
You can have spin half atom. It's very general. So it's basically, if you like, you can think about bearish phase phenomenon in real space in terms of time, right? Instead of in time space. So what I want to consider here is I want to have a magnetic field which which is uniform in space, but the orientation has a distribution which depends on R itself. And this can be even generalized to more interesting situation where this coupling is in k-space, in momentum space. But let me talk about this first situation, which is easier to consider. So what you can show is that if the velocity of electron or particles interest you, and then the gradient of this orientation, right? With how fast the orientation changes in space. If this quantity is much less than mu b naught, this is sort of real space adiabaticity condition. Okay. Once this is satisfied, you can show that this is the only Z-man field part. There's a kinetic energy of particle which I didn't write down in this Hamiltonian. But under this condition, you can show actually this quantity, okay, which I call lambda, which can be either plus one or minus one, is a conserved number. And this is an approximate statement, only valid in this condition, under this condition. Okay. So we actually can talk about particles which follow adiabatically the orientation of the magnetic field in real space. Right? And there are two ways to follow it. One is I simply follow, suppose I have this orientation goes like this, the spin will completely follow the orientation itself.
Okay, in this process, why do you need the magnetic field to be constant? Is it crucial?
It is not crucial, but for demonstration, it's easier to demonstrate
this. Yeah, it's also crucial because you know that there's no such magnetic field. You will not satisfy Maxwell equations.
Yeah. Anyway,
but then.
So I will choose this limit. Actually, this is coupling between particle spin and could be coupling between the coupling spin and the core spin lattice situation. Actually, even back. And other people can see that it's just a model. Okay. So in the real solid state,
it's
just a model. And you have this situation. So there are two ways to follow this motion. One is following the, you know, this is the situation when plus one, so the orientation of spin will precisely follow the follow the orientation of the external field. So lambda is plus one. That's another situation when the particle will always point in the opposite direction. Okay, so at this point, I point in this direction instead of this one. And then next point, I will have a rotation, which is around this direction, and then going up. So these are two actually approx eigenstates.
So how is this different from the transport of the polarization of the light field on the Poincaré sphere? Is it more or less the same thing?
I think it's probably more or less the same thing. You mean the polarization of the light?
Right.
Yeah, you can, I think. You have, yeah, I think a parallel, it's sort of parallel transport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what we're driving at is that is what how the magnetic track works.
Under this condition, okay, and then you will find out the lambda plus one particle and lambda minus one particle will experience a transverse field, okay, and this transverse field, which I called mu, would be basically determined by okay. So if you look at this space, you are in the eigenstate, and you look at the equation of motion for lambda plus one particle and lambda minus one particle, you'll find that lambda plus one particle basically will move in an effective magnetic field generated by this, specified by this equation, right? And the lambda minus one particle will experience a negative T. So this will be the field for lambda will depend on lambda itself. Okay. So in other words, if you have orientation such that this quantity actually is uniform in space, pointing on z direction, then you basically have particle moving artificial magnetic field. But the charge of this particle, right, will depend on the quantity of lambda, which is good quantum number. So basically what I'm saying is the spin up particle actually sort of act like a positive charge in this given magnetic field with no lambda, and spin down particle actually will experience a magnetic field acting on in around the opposite direction. And this will cause the splitting if you have this particle moving in the system, right? And if you know it happened that you can produce large uniform field in this way, you can actually talk about particles in artificial magnetic field with Landau levels, etc. Yeah.
So
you need a pretty large gradient.
So this is everything depend on the gradient. Yes.
Yeah. So that was my question.
So,
numbers.
No, I haven't looked. I mean, my student looked at this problem, but he mostly did some calculation about, for given gradient, how the states look like, interactions, etc. I don't think this can beat the rotating trap scenario, but it's some possibility one can do. Cattley had an experiment already of having two half scale muon configuration of magnetic field, right? And but that's two half scale muons.
What exactly is that effective field? How is that translate to force on the atoms?
Yeah, so the force of atoms, if you like, lambda will be basically velocity cross this field I write down. It's basically Lorentz force, but the force itself depends on lambda itself. The spin up, spin down particle moving the field, actually, they go along opposite directions. And remember, this is the case that the, you know, the I don't need the B, the magnitude itself don't have gradient, right? And second, to make it work, I need to prepare some topologically non-trivial configuration, such that this density is non-zero. And it is, this is a non-trivial requirement. Okay, because this is the density, I mean, in the theory of topological field, this is this means you need certain distribution of magnetic field which is topologically non-trivial to get this density.
My first paper in BEC is actually on these things, and the, what happened is that in the non-uniform trap, and the precise Maxwell equations, it would not be possible to have a field that vary directions or vary magnitude without vary directions, and just because of the
true.
Now, therefore, in all the magnetic traps, the fields, I mean, even though roughly speaking, well, but most people think that the largest trap are just changing magnitude, but all the magnetic traps, invariably, the field has to be banded.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Therefore, because once it's field banded, though, then the spin is going to align with them, so you would have very space, even very small ones. So, but then if in fact there's a trap with a very high field gradient, and then if the magnetic field bends like this, then you would have spins in the just dump the particles in the system, and then just the bare space itself would cause circulating currents. And then you will, however, as precise as one said, that one needs a very large gradient in order to produce this effective magnetic field. The largest gradient at that time is one by at Caltech, but now someone at Caltech, but now I think has left the field. Basically, you need to have the largest field gradient produced would be produced by permanent magnets, but then that would be still very small compared with the typical rotations.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, this is really not the proposal for atomic system. It's really.
But what exactly is the proposal? Is there any particular process that you think, well, this can be useful?
Yeah. So first of all, in paramagnetic systems, people studied before in solid state systems, like Jungbeck and also Ye studied in mid of 90s. This kind of Hamiltonian is relevant when the, I believe, particles hop over the lattice, have a strong coupling with the core spin. And then this kind of coupling can be relevant. And in that case, if you have background skirmia, okay, then there's...
What quantity I'm measuring that would give me... So I just don't understand what problem you want to solve yourself.
This is a Hall effect. This will give you the Hall effect,
okay,
anomalous Hall effect, right? Because what we are talking about the transverse motion, right? I mean, this will affect the transverse motion of spin up and spin down.
What about the...
Spin Hall and the Hall effect. Pardon? You mean the orbital magnetic field effect? Yeah, I didn't put it in here. It's pure spin coupling, yeah. You will have cyclotron. I mean, you will have usual orbital magnetic field effect, definitely. But this is, the part I just talked about is purely from spin rotation.
So let's stick with the spin Hall effect. So what is the geometry, what is the experimental setup, and what measurement should I perform to extract some of these results?
So for this kind of system, I can talk about this experiment by von Arnst's group. I mean, also both recently and a while ago. What you can think about then is a situation of a lattice, and there are background spins. Let me use larger arrow here, which is in paramagnetic phase. Okay, and then you have particle hop from lattice side from side to side, but suppose the coupling between the core spin, okay, which are localized, and then transport particle are strong due to, say...
Okay, so I would have this colossal magnetic resistance,
yeah.
And then
yeah.
I have a...
Yeah. due to what's if this is
then what measurement am I going to perform?
So then you can apply electrical field and then look at the Hall effect. Okay.
For Hall
effect.
For spin currents or for charge currents?
For both, because this stuff also causes some minor degree of polarization.
And the prediction for charge current is what? Which is what is accessible?
So what you study is the Hall, say, let's talk about charge current first. You look at the Hall current around this direction. So the statement is that if it happened that the system can excite ferromagnetic skirmions because of thermal effect, okay, in the small magnetic field, right, then the distribution of core spin basically will carry finite topological density. Okay, so you have core spin, which basically form a distribution which carry finite density of this one. And now when the particle move in this system, okay, when they hop around, then if the particle itself is already slightly polarized, the majority species will move in this configuration, give you net charge current contribution, right? And that being studied by Fuang Long. And I think it's still under investigation. This is a very interesting subject, actually. And
so
I think Yong Beck can.
So you say if you get a fixed density of skirmion all in the same directions, then you would have a net Hall effect in charge for charge.
Yeah, so in addition to the usual orbital effect, you will have contributions.
Well, I just want to understand what the bottom line is. I understand.
Yeah, okay. So this is the model. This is, I mean, that's the application people talk about a long time ago in the lattice model. And this is what happened in the continuous model. You have this piece of basic quantum mechanics, basically. And what I really want to talk about is actually the physics in semiconductors. In momentum space, you have certain spin configurations. But I don't think I have too much time. So I will stop here, and if there are more questions, we can have more discussions.
So, let's see. Yeah, I think maybe we should just say a pause here, and then in case people who would like to hear the rest of the story can stay, and then let's pause for some questions first.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jason said, I mean, I didn't understand all the work that you did, I mean, you skimmed over quite quickly, but even though you said it somehow doesn't apply in trapped systems, I was wondering about what happens if you have fermions in there and they pair, right? And then you turn on this effect. What happens to the?
They pair.
Suppose you have paired, you know, two spin states, and you have some kind of BCS pairing, and then you turn on this effect. What happens to the pairs?
The pairs in Zeeman field will have first order phase transition, right? I mean, if you neglect the inhomogeneous state, so if the field strength is very small, there will be nothing. I mean, they're, as Duncan said, they're paired. So if the Zeeman field is small enough, the system is stable, you don't polarize it.
You need a ferromagnetic atomic system to get anything. So if there's a local magnetization. Charge is moving in a ferromagnet and it's solid. And if it's a hole moving around, then there's the hole, it's like a spin which is opposite to the local magnetization. And I was able to pick up a very faint photo underneath the scene package. Do you need a situation where everything is, where there's a net magnetic local magnet?
Yeah.
Lincoln is actually he's talking about everything with an object has spin. So if you have triplets pairing, then
triplet pairing is better.
Same thing by what?
Triplet pairing is better.
Same pairing would mean.
Yeah, singular pairing would be difficult to break
actually,
to first place.
For these atomic systems, because they actually these so-called two spin states, they're not really a spin up, spin down, just two hyperfine spins. So actually, when you rotate a field, there might be some Baryon space effects for these, because these spins are just mixtures of some.
Right. So therefore,
maybe conceivable, there's some effect there.
Yeah.
Even though you form a pair of them, so I don't know what that is. Depends on the spin content.
Oh, yeah, yeah, depend on whether it's a pseudo spin or a real spin, right? I mean,
I was imagining that though, although they're paired weakly, so maybe the selector's strong enough, I mean, somehow the pair is broken. That's what I was
thinking. Well, yeah, basically, this field, this magnetic field, the real magnetic field coupled to these two spin states in a real way, it's not just.
There's a big analog of the electric field here, gradient to the magnetic field. But on the other hand, Kettler already make a magnetic field configuration which corresponds to Q equal to two skirmion charge.
Oh, yeah. Well,
but of course, there's always a gradient of B null field, so these two are always there together.
No, he's talking about Fermi. He's talking about Fermi. Certainly for boson, for spin. But he's talking about can I use this trick for the current type of fermion condensates, which have a pair of them with different labels
I understand that question. I'm saying that such configuration is already in experiments.
Yeah.
But the density is very low. The field density is very low. It's just a global density. Global charge of this field is only 2 or 1. So it's far away from the limit where you can produce substantial bending of the trajectory. I also. Yeah.
I don't see. I mean, I don't understand. What is the physical origin of this field?
You want to go ahead? Go ahead.
Space. Three and a half, and then the usual representation is this guy. And then because of spin, and then this is theta and phi. Mm-hmm. And then, there's an overall phase chi. But then as this turns, and then if this falls magnetic field B, and then as Fabe said, as B changes, so this guy changes, and then you can work out the current. The current here is 1 minus cosine phi, or times the gradient of theta.
Theta.
Phi. So you could whenever you change it, then there is some as long as you don't orient in some specific direction that it goes to zero, then you would have some current, and so you can change the spin rotation with the mass motion. So that's the origin. So basically, when you change the spin, then I think the other way to look at it is that this object is in, well, I like to think about it, if I multiply it by a phase factor, and this is the same as you perform a spin rotation. Along the compensation axis by I call this spinner zeta. So this is the same as either I times zeta, where L is direction of the spin of the object. But this is a simple identity, but it says that this usually relates to mass motion. And spin rotation, but it says that, again, this says that you can trade the spin rotation with mass motion, so you can oscillate like this and then generate current like that.
So what kind of spin configuration field configuration are you thinking of?
Here, what I did actually, this was as a toy model in my paper to just demonstrate this effect. I haven't thought about realistically what kind of.
For example, if I take how big is the effect on the levels?
Well, I mean,
if you want to solve the quantum mechanics of a particle with spin confined in some unusual field, take this.
Yeah.
The dominant effect is presumably going to be
So atomic traps, the effective magnetic flux, right, the magnetic length basically is of the trap size in catalyst experiment. Because the total skirmion charge is equal
to. The thing
to
is, there's a huge uniform throughout?
No, no. I mean, the trap.
The effect must be completely dominated by the analog, by the gradient of the field.
Yeah.
So this equation of motion, of course, of a
give very minor
spin is kind of like an electric and magnetic field. The electric field, the Coulomb analog force, is presumably much
dominating.
Larger than
In that, I mean, in most of situation, I would say, in most of situation, the usual Zeeman effect will dominate. In your language, is the electric field effect, right? Will dominate. So it's very difficult to see this effect.
That will also distinguish upspins and downspins.
That will also distinguish. Yeah.
Opposite direction electric analog electric field.
That will also they will also have opposite.
How important.
So I guess I need to go to the. Yeah. So.
Contribution.